Welcome to the Virginia Voice Studios. My name is Don Dale, and my guest this time is Corey Staton. And Corey, you are from Tidewater.
Yes, Norfolk, Virginia.
Norfolk, Virginia. Actually, the city of Norfolk.
Yes.
There are many interesting things about you. You're an entertainer.
Yes.
An educator.
Yep.
And you're blind.
Totally blind.
And you're black.
And I'm African American. Yes, I am a black man.
How?
And I'm handsome.
Are you? You've been told that?
Yes, definitely.
In about a few minutes, we're going to be listening to a recording that you made.
Okay.
That's part of your work in both education and entertainment. But tell me a little bit about yourself. Were you born in Norfolk?
Yes, I was born in the Hampton Roads area in Norfolk, and I actually was raised in Chesapeake, Virginia, which is about 15, 20 minutes away from Norfolk. I've always just kind of been a fun-loving person. My father was a great source of inspiration to me. He was always telling stories about his youth, and the stories were never just sitting in conversational. They were always very theatrical. And that just kind of translated into me wanting to be able to entertain people with stories, whether it be in writing or whether it be spoken word. Just started doing it back in 1999. I always had a love for history and teaching, so I just took all my passions and rolled them into one company called Can't See for Looking Edutainment Incorporated. Entertainment so extraordinary, we call it, that you forget you're being educated. And so our goal is to make learning fun for all age groups.
And do you have a specialty? Is it stand-up? How do you approach this?
Well, it's kind of a blend of one-man theatrical show, storytelling, comedy. And so basically what I do is I take historical information, for the bulk of what I do, I take historical information and I present the facts, but I frame it in the context of stories that highlight the period. So, for example, in Virginia, one of the big SOL standards, or standards of learning standards, is the Kingdom of Mali, ancient Mali, West Africa, in third grade. And so what we do is we present information from West Africa. We will tell a story about Sundiata Keita, the first king of Mali. And in that story, we present historical and geographical facts, such as the Niger River being an important trade route to Timbuktu, mm-hmm. where salt from the Sahara and gold from the Niger River Valley mines was traded to other cultures. And we also present the moral tales of the people, such as stories about Anansi the spider. But, you know, the West African culture isn't all that we do. We also do anti-bullying messages, where we call it the wolf in sheep's clothing, where we use stories that involve characters that are known as the Big Bad Wolf to teach children about how to deal with bullies in their schools or communities by reporting it to the authorities, talking about it with the parents, and ignoring the bully. And not only looking at it from the standpoint of how to handle the bully, but getting some understanding as to why bullies are bullies. You know, mm-hmm. they often feel left out or powerless, mm-hmm. so they seek to pick on other people that are less powerful than them. So we use those classic fractured fairy tales. We fracture the fairy tales to pieces, and then we put it back together our way, often using country music, blues, jazz, hip-hop, things like that, to make it more modern, for modern flavor. And we also do science-based program. We have my wife and I perform together. We have a whole entire science program about sounds and magnets and motion and the different simple machines, where we actually, it's more of a play, where within a 45 to a minute to an hour program, children are introduced to me as Dr. Know-It-All and my wife as Super Outstanding Lady, whose acronym is SOL, who's a superhero that's just having difficulties, and she comes to Dr. Know-It-All for his scientific help. So we do anything from history to fractured fairy tales to science, professional development, so a lot of different things that we get engaged in as far as being edutainers.
You talked about coming from a storytelling tradition. Have you always been a storyteller? Were you a big talker when you were in school?
Yes. And like I said, depending on what year in high school you go back to, there's probably some good stories that my teachers could tell. But I did have this one history teacher, I'll never forget her. Her name was Miss Gresham. In my senior year, she would allow me to come up and tell some of the locker room exploits of the football team, or to mimic coaches that on the team, or to tell the latest joke that, you know, I heard from my father and my uncles. And she would give me that time in class, and it was amazing because it was a great diffusion method, because once you get all that out, then, you know, me or someone like me who's a class clown or really enjoyed performing, once they got that 15-20 minutes of fame, then the rest of the class was just, you know, it was gravy as far as teaching the class, because all that energy had been diffused. So in a sense, I've always been a ham. So I actually took that, you know, I tell teachers all the time, I'm hope. So that one ham in your class might be, you know, able to use that energy in a positive way if it's directed in the right way.
What did you do after high school?
Well, I started out, I had visions of going to college to play football, but by my senior year, I kind of lost that passion for sports, the time that it took, the preparation. I was good at it, but just couldn't see myself doing that and basing my college education on my physical abilities and knowing that that could be temporary. So I went to x-ray school to be an x-ray technician in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And at that time in 94, I was just about done with my studies when I lost my vision.
That was when you were about
19 years old.
And you lost your vision in a very unusual way.
Right. What ended up happening is something they call pseudotumor cerebri, where the pressure from the cerebral spinal fluid presses on the optic nerve and chokes it off in blood, so it kills the nerve. And so that's what happened. The irony of it is, from what I was told by my neuro-ophthalmologist, is that it happens to white women over the age of 40.
Right. Yeah. And you certainly qualify for that.
Yeah, definitely. I qualify for that all the way around, you know. And I always tell my wife, I said, with odds like that, I should definitely go to Vegas.
Yeah, really. Or buy a lottery ticket.
Yeah, or something. Yeah, so it happened, and I was very depressed.
It must have been devastating.
Yeah, you know, not being able to drive and those things. All, you know, just feeling like I lost freedom. But actually, I came here to the Center for the Blind, I'd say about 97, 98-ish. I found out about the wonderful world of JAWS and talking computer software that helped blind computer users. Mm-hmm. And I've used that to go to school. And
JAWS being a program that reads you what's on the screen.
What's on the screen, correct. And I went to school at Old Dominion University, and in 2003 I graduated with a degree in cultural communication and sociology.
That must have been tough. There's so much reading involved.
Yes. My wife, she spent many nights scanning books into a Arkenstone scanner, which translates print material into spoken material for the computer. Right. Then I would sit up there and read and read and read and read and read and read, et cetera, et cetera.
Did you find that your comprehension was better, worse, or the same from when you could read words on a page or when you heard words being read aloud?
Comprehension definitely was better for me auditorially, because you have to stay so focused and you have to be able to take the information. You can't go back and reference it just visually. You have to be able to take it and then translate it into a form that you can access it again. So I would be sitting there at my computer, and I'm listening to the reading material, and then I'm actually typing on my, it was called a type and speak, which is like a portable note taker that spoke to me as well, and putting notes in it. So I would contact the information about 7 times before I was finished with it. And, you know, I learned in my communication studies that 7 times contacting information 7 different ways helps you to retain it better. And I'm proof of that, because I did graduate in 2003 with a 3.99 GPA from Old Dominion University. So I wouldn't have got that if I could see.
Can you imagine what it would have been like 20, 30 years earlier, before computers and
I can't even imagine.
how did people do it? I can't even imagine. But they did, and they became very successful, and you've become quite adept at doing what you want to do.
Yeah.
Has your lack of vision been an obstacle?
To a degree, yes and no, because it does, at certain times it gets hard. It's hard for people to look at you and take you seriously, because all they see sometimes is the cane, and they're trying to figure out, how can you do this? When are you going to be able to do it? How much money is it going to take to help you to be able to pull this off? And the wonderful thing about the performing arts is I just need a stage and a microphone.
Mm-hmm.
And everything else is in my heart and in my mind. And my wife is there performing with me, and you know, her beautiful smile is there, and her talents on with musical instruments and crowd management. We work together very well in tandem. So at that point in time, the obstacle of visual impairment becomes less of a issue, because at that point in time, I'm in my own world. Mm-hmm. And it's like the audience has been invited in versus me trying to get a job in corporate America, per se, where I have to kind of kick the door in mm-hmm. just to get half of an interview. So it's the performing arts have been good to me.
Your wife, whose name is?
Laquita Marie.
Did you meet her after your loss of vision?
No, actually, I met her in my junior year in high school. Well, actually, I'll take that back, because she'll smack me for being wrong. But I met her when I was in, we met in eighth grade at junior, well, they called it junior high back then, but
right.
Middle school now. And, you know, we didn't really, we talked, we were in class, but, you know, we really didn't get to know each other till my junior year in high school, the end of our junior year in high school. That's when we started dating. So everybody says, oh, do you know you have such a beautiful wife? I said, yes, she's 40. No, she's not 40. She's in her mid-30s now.
She's not track here.
She's in her mid-30s now, but she's always going to be 19 to me. That's the last time I actually was able to see her.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
That really is. But isn't it great that you do have visual memories of what she looks like?
Right. And the only thing that I really miss out right now is that I do not know what my girls look like. I have three daughters, Brooklyn, who's 5 and a half, Christiana, who is 3, and Camille, who is 10 months old. I don't know what they look like, but because of the visual memories, I have seen younger pictures of my wife. So when she was a mm-hmm. child, so they said, oh, well, Brooklyn was just like, you know, your wife's kindergarten picture. And I said, okay, I can picture that. Mm-hmm. They say, you know, oh, you're the one that gets a little more confusing is my middle daughter, because they say, well, she looks like you, but she looks a lot like her mom, and I'm trying to blend my beard with my wife's hair, and mm-hmm. it just doesn't work. They're all beautiful to me, and I love them to pieces. So,
do they ever try to sneak Don past the rooster because you're visually impaired? Think they can get away with stuff?
No, they're not at that quite at that age of discovery. They know that daddy can't see. They know that the things that they probably could get away with. But from the time they could walk and talk, I've instilled in them through, you know, stories and through, you know, different interactions that, you know, daddy has to be able to trust that you're where you're going to be when you say you're going to be there, and that you're doing what, you know, you said that you were going to be doing. I said, because if I can trust that, then I can feel comfortable. If I can't trust that, then you're going to sit on the couch next to me and never move.
And never date until you're 45.
Yeah. Oh, no, I got it until I'm dead. So.
Oh, okay. You are strict. You mentioned your cane earlier, and I noticed when you came in, your cane, which is standing over in the corner, that's not your white tip cane that blind people use or that we're used to seeing on the street. That's an unusual looking cane.
Yeah, it's
tell me about it.
It's a sassafras branch. My wife found it at a farmer's market. The white canes that you get, they're great. However, they're made of fiberglass, and when you're in elevators or in cars and that thing gets caught in the hinges or the door, they crack easily. My wife was tired of buying them, so she found this for like $30 at the farmer's market. She said, if you break this, she said, then you are just a super destruction machine. So I've run into curbs, I've slammed it in doors, and it has not cracked yet. So
it's a nice looking thing.
Yeah. So, and it works well for stage presence. I mean, it's kind of hard to portray 17th century or 18th century, I mean, 18th century or 19th century African American with, you know, a white tip fiberglass cane.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Tell me where your sense of humor comes from. Can you pinpoint it?
My crazy father, rest his soul, he passed away a few years ago. But my father's side of the family, every last one of them have a comedic streak in them. And my mom always said, they're the last people you want to make a mistake in front of, because it's going to become a story.
Uh-huh.
And so it was always, whenever there were family gatherings, it was almost like a competition where they would, you know, retell stories from their youth. And it was kind of like a roast, because they were, you know, actually, you know, telling stories that were, you know, would be embarrassing. But the way they told it, it was always so funny. I mean, and, you know, people would just be in stitches laughing, and they would have character voices. They would go find stuff to make costumes with. They would reenact, you know, old pastors at church or old teachers or people in the community. And it just got to be, it would be such a performance that even children that were, you know, we would be busy playing. But once they got on that front porch and went to that storytelling session, all action stopped and everything focused on my father and his brothers, you know, retelling the stories of their childhood.
Do you remember what made you think that you could combine your love of talking, mm-hmm. your love of storytelling, your sense of humor into a profession?
Well, actually, I had an opportunity to go and see a storyteller perform at a library in 97 in Chesapeake, Virginia. And he had a good presentation. He was talking about West African culture, and I've always been interested in the African side of my African-American heritage. After seeing that, I've always loved telling stories and talking. So, like I said, I just took that interest and honed it into my own personal way, because a lot of times people can see talking about, you know, the period of slavery and the transatlantic passage, it can take somewhat of a militant stance, but, you know, I'm always such a lighthearted person that, yes, that was a very ugly scar on the history of America, but out of that scar, some very beautiful things grew, and out of that, you know, I feel like I'm one of those things. You know, music, food, clothing, things of that nature. It's just, you know, a lot that can be taken from it. So I use my sense of humor to kind of soften the information so that it's more palatable, not to the sense that it's watered down, but to the sense of that people can see that I can look past the harshness of the reality and see through to the beauty that came from it.
Most of your audiences, from what I'm gathering, are young people, children. Is that correct?
Primarily, we do perform a lot in schools around up and down, you know, on the East Coast. We perform a lot in schools, libraries, and museums. But we have also performed at a lot of universities, family reunions. We performed at weddings. So we do quite a few adult crowds as well. But primarily throughout the course of a year, we're going to see more primary, middle school, and secondary students throughout the year.
Tell me about the difference between how you approach your subject matter with a young person as opposed to an adult. You obviously have two separate or two distinct ways of doing it, I would imagine.
And that is correct. I'll use, for example, just going from high school and a primary student. When I'm talking to a primary student, typically they don't have the previous knowledge of history. So when I'm talking to them, I kind of tend to tone down the verbiage as far as the complexity of words, how many words I use in a sentence, how we structure the program. We don't just, you know, spout historical information continuously. You know, we break it up with activities and interaction. We take the same approach with older students, but we're able to delve more in depth because we're not spending time building that foundation. They know that Jamestown was the first permanent settlement in America. They know that, you know, slavery occurred. They know the reasons behind slavery. But now I can spend time talking to you more about how, in that context of slavery, and I'm just using that as an example, how they actually were able to recreate their culture, because I don't have to spend time building the foundation as I would with a younger student. And with adult audiences, I tend to relate more to things that they are familiar with from their past. For example, I'll speak to the rock and roll generation by, you know, letting them know that, you know, doo-wop music isn't just, you know, something that occurred because, you know, people like to sing. I said actually something that occurred in inner city, urban, and African-American communities. And it's just a continuation of when you don't have instruments to make music, you make music by doing something else. So the, you know, that comes the bass guitar.
Now you weren't even alive when that started. I lived through.
Yeah, but I'm a big fan of the doo-wop era. You know, Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers.
Yes.
Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons.
Uh-huh.
And coming all the way from, and my dad raised me on beach music in Motown. So,
oh,
I mean,
had really good taste.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, you know, and he taught me a lot. He was like, you know, oh, you kids think that hip hop is something you guys just invented, you know,
oh,
in
no.
the 80s. He said, oh, no, we've been hip hopping for years.
Mm-hmm.
He said, and, you know, he actually would, you know, play the songs for me. And to hear, you know, James Brown's songs to be, you know, being played. The get on up, you know, stay on the scene like a sex machine.
Mm-hmm.
That song, then to hear that same bass line and beat and syncopation played in a hip-hop song. So, okay, well, yeah, James Brown was an originator of hip-hop music, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it just goes back. And what I tell young people and old people, like, that every day is history. So everything that's happening now is built upon something that happened yesterday, that was built upon something that happened last year, that was built upon something that happened 5,000 years ago. So that's the joy of history to me, and that's the way I teach it.
Is that the way? It sounds like you're saying you make it relevant to their lives.
Exactly.
That way.
Exactly.
And so they can understand, okay, this does affect me.
Correct. And the first thing I do out of the gate, and I'm speaking mainly from my history programs that I do, because I do science programs and the anti-bullying and other types of programming. But for the history programs, I always, you know, I gauge the audience, and I always do what's called a sound check. And I'll say, you know, young people, let me hear you. They'll make some noise. I say, well, not so young people, let me hear you. And depending on the balance is where I start. And, you know, I always say, you know, for example, I'll say, Virginia's home to many firsts, the first permanent colony, the Confederate capital of the South, and home to Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the Declaration of Independence. But in 1609 and 1619, Virginia also witnessed the birth of, and I say, hip-hop. And, of course, the young people immediately are like, wow. And then the older people are like, what? And so from there, I just jump off into the history lesson. And we do this a lot in Colonial Williamsburg with a company called World Strides that brings tour groups from California and other states to Virginia. And we do that. And at the end, it's always said, you know, if I had history teachers like this when I was in school, I would not have gotten that D minus that I got when I was a kid. And
that must make you feel really good.
It does. It makes me, it validates me, and it makes me feel like, okay, the people are actually getting it. They're not just being entertained by the blind guy, they're being edutained by the blind guy. So they're learning while they're enjoying themselves.
What? How do you see this developing? I mean, you're a young man. You're 36, I think you said.
Correct.
And you've got another 30 years of professional life ahead of you, at least, or one would think.
Right.
Where do you see it going?
Well, right now we're doing a lot of CD recording. For example, the Oink Yeah Three Pigs remix CD that you mentioned, and we're also doing an African folktale CD, and we're now currently in the process of developing those into books that can be like read-along books. Mm-hmm. And eventually what I'd like to be able to do is to take those, some of my creative writing, which I've also done in script format, to have those animated, such as the, you know, a new animated version of the Three Pigs, which I'm currently seeking investor or sponsorships right now. My dream would be to actually, you know, be able to one day to be to have a television show like, you know, Nickelodeon or, you know, PBS or, you know, some of those other stations that appeal to children and young people, and so that they can get exposed to our brand of entertainment. Because like you said, when I'm 56, I don't still want to be traveling and living out of a suitcase. And by that point, I like to be just getting a limousine ride to a studio, jumping out, and then going back home.
With a little bling.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You do take a great deal of satisfaction out of what you do now, though.
Oh, that's most definitely. I mean, like I said, it is very challenging that to travel and to go to different locations and set up. And like I said, people think that's glamorous. Oh, you get to stay in hotels and you get to eat out a lot. It's like, yeah, but that looks glamorous when you're talking about the you know, the rock star that has a road crew and all they do is walk on the stage behind, sit up behind the guitar and sing and play for the audience. I said, well, it's for me. You know, my wife and I, we have to, you know, lug those instruments and all the props and things onto the stage, then pack them back up, you know, drive ourselves to the hotels, you know, things like that. And then, you know, you throw three small children into the mix, you know, finding childcare. It does become very challenging, but the reward comes in when, you know, even if it's just that one child that comes up to us or that one teacher that comes up and says, you know what, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this. And, you know, I've had children ask me for my autograph like I was some celebrity. And I had one child say, you know, I never knew that somebody that's blind could teach like this. And thank you. You've inspired me to do, you know, to want to learn more about history. So those moments make it worthwhile.
Do you think children focus less on your lack of ability to see than adults do?
I think the children, it's kind of, because I do tell them at the beginning of every what we call on-stage adventure, I let them know that I'm visually impaired. They don't get it by my stage name, Corey the Talented Blind Guy, which is what I use as a stage name. They get it by the information that I present. And it's immediate shock value to them because it's like, there's no way. And mm-hmm. then as it progresses, what the children always come back and say is that, you know, are you really blind? You can't be because you're so good at this thing. And then when you tell them, like, yes, I am, they're like, I forgot you were blind. They come up trying to give me high fives and things like that. Mm. Oh, I forgot that you were blind. So that becomes interesting. The teachers, when I tell them, they kind of sit back and say, okay, now we're going to watch the children and how they react because this is really going to be interesting.
Well, adults tend to try to be polite.
Well,
if the kids just blurt out what they're thinking.
Exactly. And it's every now and then the adults will come up and they'll more or less say, this is such a rewarding experience for the children because it exposed them to so many levels of diversity. And, you know, we appreciate the fact that you were so open about sharing.
Speaking of sharing, we're going to share with the audience here in just a couple minutes a bit of Oink Yeah. Set it up for us.
Well, Oink Yeah is a fractured fairy tale version of the classic Three Little Pigs fairy tale. Basically what ends up happening, just in a little background, my oldest daughter, I started telling this to her in the classic way when she was a baby, and it just got boring to me, so I started adding more of myself into the story, and myself love, and I love music. So by the time it's all said and done, you have a mother pig who's very frustrated with three of her three lazy teenagers, who all they want to do is listen to music, you know, country, western, blues, and jazz, which are their favorite. She sends, unlike the classic fairy tale where they go happily on their way, she actually kicks them out of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, they're forced to find a way to make it on their own.
And you're doing all the voices.
Doing all the voices. They blend, you know, of course, the straw, the hay, the sticks, the bricks, and the country western pig, you know, the straw, the blues pig gets the sticks, and the jazz pig gets the bricks.
I love the jazz pig accent. I love the way you do that voice.
And after they, thanks, man.
Yeah, yeah, that's it.
But after they build their house, of course, there comes the classic big bad wolf. But as you listen to the songs and the dialogue and the story, you begin to see that the wolf is not just a bully without a cause. He's a bully with pressure from home. His wife is upset with him because they don't have food to eat in the house, things of that nature. Kind of speaks to the economy today, but I digress.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they have their classic, you know, battle with the huffing and the puffing and the blowing the house in. But in the end, what ends up happening is the three pigs are forced to live together in the brick house. And they discover their musical talents blended together is basically what leads to the development of hip hop in fairy tale land. And there's a little surprise twist at the end with the wolf as well, what he brings to the table. So without, you know, telling you the whole story, but it follows the pattern of the development of hip hop in this country. When Africans come to America, they bring their musical styles and begin to combine them with European musical forms, which leads to the foundations of country western and blues.
Mm-hmm.
And that music continues to evolve through the ages until you get to the hip hop era. So it's a mini history lesson, but framed in the form of a fractured fairy tale.
If somebody wants a copy of this, what can they do?
They can go to my website. The website is www.Corey, C-O-R-E-Y, is how you spell it, CoreyTheTalentedBlindGuy.com. Again, that's www.Corey, C-O-R-E-Y, TheTalentedBlindGuy.com. And they can go to our website, look at our products, hear a sample of it, and they can order it. It costs $10, you know, plus shipping. We'll ship it out to you as soon as, you know, we get the order and we fill it. It comes, you know, packaged in a nice, you know, CD case. If you want an autograph, you know, when you make your order, just let us know that you'd like to have an autograph, and we'll do that for you as well. So it's, you know, definitely it's good. Everybody that's has it and has purchased it, the one thing they will say is, like, you know, I know for 30 minutes out of the day, my grandchildren or my niece or my nephew or my child is quiet. And there are people that are trying to get YouTube footage up now of the children as they actually reenact the whole CD.
Fantastic.
And so, yeah, so definitely makes a great gift for, you know, birthdays and for children of all ages. It's great for car rides.
And keeps them quiet.
Yes, it keeps them quiet.
Corey, thank you for being our guest today on the Virginia Voice. I'm Don Dale. My guest has been Corey Staton. And we're going to listen right now to a little bit of Onkia.